Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. China, of course, is top of mind when we talk about the need to protect our country. And when we talk about China, we are blessed from time to time to be able to talk about it with one of our country's preeminent experts on the subject, particularly the military capabilities that the Chinese Communist Party has been amassing now for, well, decades, much of it with our help, and the implications that those forces now have in particular for our vital interests, well, certainly in the Western Pacific, but possibly quite far beyond. Our guest's name is Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired. In the course of his distinguished career as a naval intelligence officer, he rose through the ranks to become the chief of intelligence for the U.S. Pacific Fleet. He has retired from the service, but not from the fight. I'm very pleased to say he is a fellow with the Geneva Center for Security Policy, not to be confused with ours in Washington. But he is also very active as a member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, and in myriad other ways, very much keeping people aware of the challenges we're facing from China and how they are evolving. Captain, we're always appreciative of you doing that here. Welcome back to Securing America, sir.
Thanks, Frank. It's great to be with you as always.
I want to get sort of a stock-taking. One of the things that I value so much about you, Captain, is you are really staying abreast of day-to-day developments. And let's level set for this conversation on what the Chinese are doing at the moment and what it portends for our friends in Taiwan, as well as our vital interests in the continued independence of that nation.
Well, Frank, I think you had Grant Newsham on a few days ago and talked about the Python or the Anaconda strategy. And I think what we've seen since the 4th through the 7th of August is a real bump up in a new plateau of Chinese coercion against the people of Taiwan and the peace and stability of the region. So that military power demonstration, or what I think was a Taiwan invasion dress rehearsal, set a new precedent for what's going to be normal operations in the cross-strait environment. And so what we've seen over the last week or two is on a daily basis, reports from the Taiwan Ministry of Defense reporting out the activity of PLA Air Force and PLA Naval Air Forces crossing the center line on a routine basis, flying 25 to 35 aircraft in and around Taiwan, a dozen or more naval vessels from the PLA Navy operating around Taiwan. This is something that didn't really occur before this big demonstration. So we're in a new world now. We're in a new era where China has basically moved several inches closer to, several feet closer, miles closer, in terms of getting into the face of the Taiwan and putting a real strain on their defense capabilities. And so, we're really watching something new here. And this gives them an advantage in any case. If they want to conduct an invasion, they're going to have a lot less room to travel, a lot less preparations to make in some sense, because they're constantly showing this kind of fist to Taiwan. And now it's really getting much more bold. And as the PRC told us, they don't recognize Taiwan as anything other than a province. And so they've crossed that center line that, interestingly enough, since when it was kind of established in 1954 through 2020, in those almost 70 years, there was only four times that PLA aircraft crossed the center line. And what we saw so far over the last couple of weeks or last month, they're almost crossing on a daily basis. And so this really changes parameters and puts a strain on the leadership in Taiwan to understand whether or not they're actually going to be attacked from an invasion that starts with the aircraft.
Mm-hmm. And this goes to something we talked about with you in your last visit here, Jim, the reduction in what you call in the intelligence business indicators and warnings. if this op tempo, operational tempo, is maintained at a high level, and I think, you know, it's not inches, it's not even feet, it's definitely miles that they've gotten closer to Taiwan, indeed surrounding the island. The loss of those indicators and warnings may mean that they could move from more or less a standing start into actual attacks should they decide to do so. And are you still persuaded, Captain, that what's coming is not just an effort to sort of garrote the island of Taiwan with, in effect, a blockade, but actual kinetic attack on the island itself?
I think they're going to continue to try to pressurize Taiwan, and they may attempt to blockade in some sense, but to make a blockade effective, you're going to have to sink a ship or shoot down an aircraft or do something beyond just firing missiles into established closure areas, which people will operate around. If they know there's a closure area, they'll operate around it and it'll be business as usual. So to effectively implement a blockade, they're going to have to fire weapons. And I believe at that point, if Xi Jinping and the Central Military Commission decide to fire weapons, that they're not just going to do it for a blockade. They're going to go all the way, because at that point, they'll know that whatever they do will be misinterpreted, and they have to finally do the final strike swiftly, short, sharp war, as some of them have written in China, to be able to seize and capture Taiwan before the United States and our allies can do anything to obstruct their plan. And so at this point, I think a war is very possible. And I'm hearing that from people that would never have said that before. People that have been kind of reluctant to admit that are now coming out here in the last week or two, starting to say it's very possible we may see a conflict in the next year or two. And so I think we need to be prepared for that.
I couldn't agree more. And you, of course, have been warning about this for, well, decades, I think it's fair to say. And I think rightly so, warning specifically that we're in a period of heightened concern over that possibility. And Jim, just again to level set, are you still of the view that if the Chinese do decide to go for it and do recognize that the United States coming to Taiwan's aid is probably decisive in how an invasion would play out, that they will, in fact, attack our assets, our personnel, and or our territory, certainly out of the Pacific and perhaps beyond, as part of their campaign to assure that they do succeed?
Again, Frank, I think they will, because if they decide to take that step, which they haven't wanted to take in some sense, they wanted to acquire territory like they did at Scarborough, like they did in the Spratlys, like they're doing in the Solomons. They like to get things without having to fire a shot. That's the acme of skill, strategy, as Sun Tzu said. But yeah, once they make that decision to go, we know that they've trained their rocket force to shoot our bases in Yokosuka, Japan. We know that they have ballistic missiles that are designed to kill carriers. So they're preparing, and they got weapons that are designed to strike Guam. So they're preparing to strike all of the nodes and operating bases that we have in the Western Pacific. And I don't see them not going there when they know it will all be on the line. And failure to take Taiwan, failure to achieve mission, will end in the end of the regime. So they can't lose. So they're going to do everything in their power. And they also know that we're likely not going to strike the mainland because they've seen what we're doing in the Ukraine. And they know that there's a fear about doing that because they have nuclear weapons now, and they have many more weapons than they used to have.
Captain, hold that thought. We're going to come back to that and more about the Solomon Islands and the challenge we're facing from China with Captain Jim Fennell, United States Navy, retired, right after this.
The
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In recent months, the Iranian regime has redoubled its threatening behavior. For example, it has plotted to kill former U.S. officials in our country. It has enriched uranium effectively to bomb grade and finally acknowledged that it has the option to deploy nuclear weapons. And Iran's proxy militiamen in Iraq have just flexed their muscles by attacking government buildings and even the U.S. embassy in Baghdad's supposedly secure green zone. While their leader Muqtada al-Sadr has ordered them to withdraw, the point has been made. They can take over there at any time. Incredibly, Team Biden's response to such abiding and growing threats is to press on with the completion of a new deal that has no prospect of blocking the mullah's nuclear ambitions. Instead, it will simply help underwrite, legitimate, and otherwise enable them. That's simply insane and must be abandoned. This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back. A very special welcome once again to our guest, Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired, great member of our Committee on the Present Danger of China, and leader, really, in understanding and advocating action by our country about the Chinese Communist Party threat, particularly the military one that is now becoming more dangerous by the day, especially in the Western Pacific. Jim, you mentioned in the last block that you are concerned about what the Chinese are doing in the Solomon Islands. We had one of your colleagues, former Army Colonel John Mills, on yesterday talking about the Solomons as a place where the Chinese have now turned our left flank, as he put it, by essentially not only getting access to those hallowed grounds, but also blocking a Coast Guard cutter from a port call there. There's been some developments on that front in the past 24 hours, and I wanted you to just walk us through where you see things standing with the Solomons at the moment and their strategic implications.
Yes, Frank, it seems that there's a broiling controversy that's going on in the Solomons with Prime Minister Sogavare and his decision from 2019 to move the Solomon Islands from recognizing Taiwan to recognizing the PRC. And this, in the last 2 days, we've seen this report that our Coast Guard cutter was denied access. Then there was some controversy regarding that because we have a status of forces agreement from 1991 with the Solomon Islands, with the United States, that wouldn't have allowed for something like that to happen without better consultations. And then apparently in the last 10, 12 hours, Prime Minister Sogavare's come out and said, oh, we didn't just deny the United States, but we're denying access to the Solomon Islands from all warships of all nations as we go through a review of our protocols. So we're not sure what that exactly means. I think time will tell us in the next week or two or 2 or 3 months. We may see a PLA Navy warship pull in and get some announcement that the Solomon Islands has come up with a new protocol with the PRC.
Yeah.
Even though they told us.
People's Liberation Army Navy, of course, is what PLA stands for. Interestingly, Jim, he said it, I gather, as the U.S. naval ship Mercy, hospital ship, was making a port call, a very welcome one, evidently, in the Solomons. Does that bear on this at all, do you think? Is this just maneuvering, window dressing, a serious challenge?
I think what Prime Minister Sogavare did today, especially since the Mercy was pulling in, and the Mercy is part of the U.S. Navy, but it's a white-hulled ship. It's considered a non-combatant. And so I think Sogavare was trying to tamp down some of the obvious uncomfortableness of having an American Navy hospital ship pull in to provide help to his people by what had occurred the day before with the denial and the news about the denial of the Coast Guard cutter. So I think that's a little bit of his window dressing to try to make the Mercy's port call for Pacific Partnership seem not so uncomfortable. So we'll see after the Mercy pulls out where they go with this.
Indeed, we will. Jim, this brings me to more generally, where do you think we stand? If this goes badly for us, is this evidence of, as John Mills put it, a serious strategic blow affecting kind of the left flank, as he puts it, in the second island chain and creating new opportunities for the Chinese to operate against Taiwan, among other things? And are preparations for, you know, what the Chinese are up to measuring up? I'm thinking particularly about the fact that the Navy has announced that they're going to retire 39 combatant vessels in this budget year. It seems unbelievable that we would be doing that at such a moment as this.
Yeah, Frank, I think what we're seeing play out in the South Pacific, like at the Solomons, the Guadalcanal, or at Kiribati, Tarawa, that these places have been neglected for a long time. And I think, you know, we don't have a State Department and a Defense Department that's really come up with the kind of recommendations and ideas that need to be implemented to bring in the private sector to help these islands, you know, achieve some of the level of, help for their, the impoverished people. And so we're kind of facing a desperate situation where we're really not present. And so when we have an administration that submits a budget that would decrease the number of warships in the U.S. Navy, you know, a lot of times folks will say, well, we don't need to have more warships because we're using high-tech network-centric warfare, distributed maritime operations. And so the number of ships isn't as important as the platforms and the capabilities that they have. And I don't disagree with that. But there is something that's critically important in places like the Solomons, and in Kiribati and Vanuatu and Fiji, is that if you don't see a United States Navy warship or a Coast Guard cutter pulling into your port and seeing American sailors come out and help and assist you, then you don't really think America's really interested or there. And so ships in that sense really do matter. And from my time in the Pacific Fleet, at Seventh Fleet and other places in the Pacific, we don't have enough assets to cover all of our requirements, to cover the Korean Peninsula, to cover the threat from China against Taiwan, to cover what China's doing in the South China Sea, and then to also be able to provide presence in the South Pacific, or to help our, assist our allies in Australia or New Zealand, or to go out to the Indian Ocean and work with our allies in India. So all of those areas require presence, and presence requires a gray hull, a floating piece of metal, or a submerged piece of metal like a submarine or an aircraft, where we show up and our sailors, our Americans, rub elbows and shake hands and provide assistance and show that we care about our friends and allies. And we're not doing that. And when we don't have those ships and those airplanes and those submarines, it takes away our credibility. And China is filling that vacuum.
Just one quick point on this, Jim. You mentioned presence. Our presence is substantially in most of those waters and airspace transitory. I'm thinking just this week we had the transiting of the Taiwan Strait by two Navy cruisers, as I understand it. And, you know, that's a powerful symbol and important gesture, but it is transitory. And that contrasts with, as you said, now this daily routine of the Chinese operating in and over and under those waters and doing so, in fact, inside the economic zone of and air defense zone of Taiwan. Presence is something that we've got to put more of a premium on, it seems to me, and not retiring these hulls is one way to do that, at least in the short term. Jim, very quickly, there's been a major naval exercise out in the Pacific, the biggest in the world, RIMPAC, it's called. You've participated in and been a driving force behind that for much of your career. The Chinese have been collecting intelligence on it, as they've often done in the past. At least, I guess they weren't invited to participate in it this year. That's some progress. But just very quickly, sir, in less than a minute, the significance of the intelligence that they're gleaning from the presence that we've had with those exercises.
Well, we just had this 7th Fleet commander talk about U.S. naval operations in the Western Pacific inside the first island chain, where they encounter PLA Navy, PLA warships, and they talk about the intelligence that we're collecting from those encounters with the Chinese. So we should not be naive enough to think that when Chinese intelligence collection vessels are operating in the Hawaiian operation area during RIMPAC, that they're also not collecting information of value to their mission. So they're going to collect signals intelligence, electronic intelligence, maybe communications intelligence, and certainly possibly acoustic intelligence, because we have submarines in Pearl Harbor. So we have to be prepared for the reality that they're collecting tactical intelligence that can be used in a combat environment like the defense of Taiwan, where those signals and information can be translated into weapons on target.
We have to leave it at that. Captain Jim Fennell, United States Navy retired. God bless you, sir. Thank you for your time and your expertise. Keep coming back to us with updates, if you would. Next up, we'll speak with the Prime Minister in exile of East Turkestan, Salih Hudayar, about genocide in China right after this.
Black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Continue our conversation about the Chinese Communist Party and the threat that it represents with a case study, really, of both the nature of this regime and how it is trying to disinform the rest of us about its true character and its intentions. We're going to talk about this in the context of what the CCP is doing with respect to a minority population in Western China, an area that has previously been known as East Turkestan. The Chinese call it Xinjiang. The population most impacted is a community of Uyghur Muslims, some 3 million of whom are being brutally repressed in concentration camps, as the rest of the population is suffering outside of them. But you wouldn't know that from the way the Chinese are trying to distort and disinform us about what's happening there. To talk about all of this, I'm delighted to have with us the Prime Minister in exile of East Turkestan. His name is Salih Hudayar. He's been on this program a number of times, and we're always happy to catch up with him, but especially so in the context and in the aftermath of an important report from the Department of State in the United States government. And we're going to visit about that, as well as the truth about what's happening to the Uyghur population and other ethnic minorities, by the way, East Turkestan. Salih, it's good to have you back, sir. Welcome once again.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with what the Chinese Communist Party is saying and trying to get the rest of us to believe about what's happening to your people. A product of something called the Global Engagement Center released last week. The implications of it are that there's a very serious effort underway to not only deny the truth, but to persuade us that anyone who says otherwise is to be disbelieved. Talk about this report, if you would, and its findings.
Yes, the State Department's Center for Global Engagement recently released a report on the Chinese government's efforts to manipulate facts regarding East Turkestan, or what the Chinese government calls Xinjiang. Over the past several years, the Chinese government has been engaging in a brutal campaign of genocide, which has been recognized as genocide by the United States government, along with parliaments of many European countries and Canada. The Chinese government, in effort to push back against this and to hide its atrocities, it's been using a variety of means, including, you know, paid actors, including using Western-based social media platforms like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, which are actually banned inside China, even YouTube, to promote this lies, these propaganda that there is no genocide happening and that people are living very happily. In addition to that, they've also bought a lot of medias in much of the third world, in like neighboring countries like the Central Asian Republics, in the Middle East. They've invited, you know, journalists from these countries and showed them specific areas, you know, tourist attractions where they have Uyghurs singing and dancing, or people dressed up as Uyghurs. And sometimes if we look at these videos, these people are not even Uyghurs, but rather Han Chinese people dressed up in Uyghur clothing to manipulate the fact that, you know, Uyghurs are being oppressed, and to show that Uyghurs are singing and dancing. This is an extensive effort by the Chinese government that has proliferated since, you know, international condemnation of its atrocities.
By importantly, both the Trump and Biden administrations, among many others, who have formally called what's happening in Xinjiang, East Turkestan, genocide. Give us the truth as you've seen it and documented it, Saleh. The record is pretty stark, and it's not just from, you know, sources who have an interest in painting this darkly. As I understand it, there's been an international tribunal out of the UK that reached the same conclusions. No.
Yes. Atrocities of the Uyghurs, the ongoing situation, the ongoing genocide, really started in 2014. But the basis for this actually goes back much longer, when the People's Republic of China was first established, and they subsequently invaded and occupied East Turkestan. Effectively, they have been colonizing it for the past 72 years. And with the rise of Xi Jinping to power in 2013, and his promotion of achieving the so-called Chinese dream and obtaining Chinese national rejuvenation, that's when the People's Republic of China and the CCP launched the so-called People's War campaign back in May of 2014. And since then, the Chinese government has detained at least 3 million people, according to the U.S. Department of Defense, in so-called vocational training re-education camps, which the international community, including the Department of Defense, states is concentration camp. In these camps, people are being subject to torture, rape, sterilization, organ harvesting, and even summary execution. Outside of the camps, life is just as much gruesome as inside the camps. Constant surveillance, you have Chinese officials living in your home, monitoring your every actions, even sleeping with you. For example, if you're a man, you're taken to the camps, your children are taken into so-called boarding schools to be educated as, quote, loyal Chinese citizens. And so if your wife is stuck at home, they send the Chinese male official to monitor her activities and to pair them up as a family. Essentially, God knows what is happening in that home. All of this has been recognized as genocide. Everything that the Chinese government is doing is in line with the definition of genocide underlined in the UN Genocide Convention. And of course, the Chinese government's reason for this is they're using the narrative that they are modernizing it and that this is a form of anti-terrorism and anti-separatism, which is far from the facts.
And they are also exploiting the very considerable resources of East Turkestan for the benefit of the Chinese Communist Party, of course. Sally, you mentioned the Genocide Convention, and I just want to emphasize that this is a document to which we are a party. The Chinese are a party as well. But every nation that is has an obligation under the treaty not only to call out genocide where it's occurring, but to punish it, do they not? And if that's the case, what is the Biden administration doing, if anything, about this, other than documenting that we're being disinformed about it?
Unfortunately, the Biden administration has not done much. This is the sad reality, other than, as you mentioned, documenting it and stating that it is a genocide. And, you know, taking small, minimal efforts, such as, you know, the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act to prevent goods made from the forced or slave labor of Uyghurs coming into the United States, not much is being done. What really needs to be done is that the United States needs to raise this issue, bring it to the agenda of the UN Security Council. It needs to urge the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice to investigate and prosecute Chinese officials and the Chinese state for its ongoing genocide. It also needs to take, you know, other measures, strong diplomatic measures, you know, even expelling Chinese officials or diplomats from the United States, banning all goods that are made in China from coming into the United States, because it's not just goods that are made in East Turkestan where Uyghurs are being used as slave labor. You have Uyghurs being relocated into Chinese provinces to be used as slave labor and forced labor in factories. In addition, you have other ethnic groups like Tibetans, you know, Falun Gong, others being used as forced and slave labor as well. So yeah. There needs
Sully,
to be
done. Yeah, and let me just ask you about this slave labor legislation. It's my understanding that the administration not only isn't extending the reach beyond Xinjiang, but they've actually been waiving imports into this country, I should say, from Xinjiang or East Turkestan, despite this statutory prohibition. Is that true?
It has been true in some cases. In fact, just the other day, I read a news article about goods, you know, fruits and other products that are made by the Bingtuan, you know, which is the XPC, the Xinjiang Production Construction Corps, which is a 3.5 million strong paramilitary force specifically sent to East Turkestan to colonize it and facilitate the genocide, being sold within 10 miles from the White House, you know, here in Washington, D.C. So there are still products that are coming in. In addition, you have, you know, solar products that are being made by Chinese companies who operate in East Turkestan, who have
very high priority for the administration to get those brought into this country. Sally, we have to leave it at that. I'm afraid we're out of time. We'll look forward to further updates from you. And I certainly agree with your condemnation of what the Chinese government is doing to your people and so many others in communist China. We're going to talk about what is being done by the Chinese, among others, to our electric grid with our colleague Tommy Waller of the Center for Security Policy right after this. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In recent months, the Iranian regime has redoubled its threatening behavior. For example, it has plotted to kill former U.S. officials in our country. It has enriched uranium effectively to bomb grade and finally acknowledged that it has the option to deploy nuclear weapons. And Iran's proxy militiamen in Iraq have just flexed their muscles by attacking government buildings and even the U.S. embassy in Baghdad's supposedly secure green zone. While their leader Muqtada al-Sadr has ordered them to withdraw, the point has been made. They can take over there at any time. Incredibly, Team Biden's response to such abiding and growing threats is to press on with the completion of a new deal that has no prospect of blocking the mullah's nuclear ambitions. Instead, it will simply help underwrite, legitimate, and otherwise enable them. That's simply insane and must be abandoned. This is Frank Gaffney. Back, and we're going to turn to a topic that is very much on my mind and probably on an awful lot of other Americans at the moment, because CBS News 60 Minutes program has, for the second time in about 6 months, aired a program about the vulnerability of our most critical of critical infrastructures, the electric grid. A man who has devoted much of his professional life, at least the civilian part of his professional life, for the past decade or so, is our next guest. He is a friend and colleague of mine at the Center for Security Policy. He has been the director of its infrastructure security program, and I'm very pleased to announce for the first time here on Securing America, he is fleeted up, as they say in the Marines, to become the executive vice president of the center and will become the president and CEO of the organization at the beginning of the new year. His name is Lieutenant Colonel Tommy Waller, United States Marine Corps Reserves. He is a force reconnaissance Marine, which means he's the very pointy end of the spear of the Marine Corps, and a very impressive man in every respect, both as a warrior and as a leader in his civilian capacity. We're delighted to have him back. Tommy, welcome once again to Securing America.
Yeah, thank you, Frank, for having me on. And your listeners may have heard me say this before. If not, then it is true that I don't think there's anything I ever did in uniform or would ever do that would actually have a difference, make a difference in the day-to-day survival of the American people. And so what you and I both realize and what we hope America can wake up to realize is that the grid, the electricity that they use every day, has everything to do with their day-to-day survival. And we just can't afford to lose it.
Well, you're very modest about your accomplishments, but you're certainly right that without electricity, we cease to exist as an organization, particularly over a period of time. Tommy, talk a little bit about this 60 Minutes piece. The passage of the past 6 months in particular is of concern to me because it seems as though we haven't seen the kind of progress that one would have hoped for by the Biden administration, despite the enormous amount of money that they've got for infrastructure upgrades.
Right. Yeah, Frank, the first episode that 60 Minutes aired was February 28th. So just really right before President Biden's State of the Union address. And of course, there was a lot of fanfare around that initial segment from those of us that care about the security of the grid. You know, finally, someone like CBS and 60 Minutes is covering it. And one of the most revealing things about it was their interview with multiple senior Biden administration officials, people that are working in the White House, you know, who are responsible for national security, and their admission that there's no one in charge. There's no one in charge of the security of the electric grid. They don't feel that they have the authority to compel the utilities to actually protect their infrastructure. The second worrisome thing, Frank, as you mentioned, 6 months later, almost to the day, CBS aired that segment, almost identical segment again, and it doesn't appear that there's been any progress in some of those critically important factors that were brought up the first time. So it's a worrisome trend that the federal government and utility industry are not taking threats nearly seriously enough. And it's one that we seek to rectify as soon as we can.
Tommy, just to calibrate on this, what is the problem? The electric grid is something that is ubiquitous in our society. Most of us know it to be extremely reliable. I mean, it's just second nature. You hit that light switch, you expect the lights to come on and power everything else, for that matter. And yet there are real concerns about, if not the reliability of the grid necessarily under normal circumstances, but its resilience. What are those problems?
The biggest problem, Frank, is an overall lack of awareness that there is a problem, that there are vulnerabilities, right? So we think about, for example, the U.S. government and the utility industry's investments in things that they perceive that there's an awareness and demand for. So take, for example, renewables, right? Wind and solar. Nothing against wind and solar. At the local household level, they can be extremely helpful with respect to resilience if you've got proper battery backup, etc. But what we've seen is that these types of renewable sources of energy have been thrust upon the grid as a whole with massive subsidies and incentives created so that they could be put onto the grid, even despite that they're intermittent. They require things like natural gas and other forms of generation to back them up when the sun doesn't shine or the wind doesn't blow. Well, why is that? It's because the government and the utility industry had perceived that the American people wanted clean energy, that they perceive that there's a climate crisis, for example. And so at the end of the day, the largest problem we have is an overall lack of appreciation for the vulnerabilities of the grid and the need to secure it from all hazards. And that's if we took care of that, then everything else would fall into place. The government would decide to put someone in charge. The utility industry would decide to make the investments. And so that's the number one challenge we have, is waking up the nation.
When you talk about all hazards, Tommy, a guy who devoted, I think, virtually all of his waking hours for decades to arousing us to this danger, unfortunately passed away prematurely 2 weeks or so ago now, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. Talk a little bit, if you would, about the kinds of things that Peter was frantic about in terms of these vulnerabilities and the role he played in trying to both identify them and fix them.
Absolutely. So Dr. Pry was truly a national treasure. Nowhere had I ever seen a combination of someone who had a grasp of history that had observed, you know, thousands of years of human history and civilizations falling because of their inability to see what threatened them. And then combine that with a deep knowledge of our adversaries, starting off in his case with the Soviet Union, and then in particular how those adversaries think about fighting the United States. And so Dr. Pry for decades analyzed these threats. He analyzed them from an unconstrained, unbiased perspective, and he wrote diligently about it, authored numerous books. And really, I think I've heard you say it before, Frank, and I agree with you that he really was the catalyst that started so many of the rest of us to appreciate the most significant hazard to the grid, which is electromagnetic pulse.
Hold that thought. We're going to come right back on that point with more about EMP and what we need to do about it right after this. Welcome back. We are having one of the most important conversations we can have, and that is about protecting our country from the dangers posed to the most critical of our critical infrastructures, our electric grid, by a variety of hazards. And we're speaking with a man who has spent an awful lot of time addressing this problem, organizing efforts to counter it, and to essentially assure that we have not only a reliable electric system in this country, but one that is resilient against a variety of hazards. His name is Lieutenant Colonel Tommy Waller, United States Marine Corps Reserves, the Executive Vice President of our Center for Security Policy. And Tommy, you were just introducing this term electromagnetic pulse, or EMP, and the work that Dr. Peter Vincent Pry helped lead in both recognizing that danger and addressing the implications of it for our electric grid. And finish that thought, if you would, and describe what else we have to be worried about as well that requires attention urgently.
Sure. Yeah, Dr. Pry was the preeminent EMP warrior, if you want to call it, the man in our country who had so much passion and knowledge and networks. I mean, no one else I knew was connected to so many people who for many decades, whose job it was, starting with Dr. William Graham, who was the chairman of the Congressional EMP Commission and present during some of the United States' first high altitude nuclear tests. This is a phenomenon maybe Americans don't know much about, but they need to, because it's one that could catastrophically end our society by taking down our electric grid. We worked, of course, with Dr. Pry for years, and will continue to carry on the legacy he started to make sure that Americans, and particularly our policymakers, are awake to this hazard of electromagnetic pulse, and that they do the things that they need to in order to address it. But Frank,
in fact,
you mentioned,
we're going to call the work that you've been about the Pry Project going forward at the Center for Security Policy, and would welcome people who want to assure Peter's living legacy to check out our site, securefreedom.org or securethegrid.com. Peter is going to be much missed, needless to say, but he was also concerned about other threats to the grid. Talk about them very quickly, if you would, Tommy.
Absolutely. Yeah, nuclear EMP is just one. You've got, of course, natural EMP, solar weather that comes from the sun, very similar phenomenon created naturally. And then, of course, you've got man-made threats like cyber attack, physical sabotage, and something that we've seen recently, Frank, that's very worrisome and not at all being addressed by the Biden administration, which is supply chain vulnerabilities. 2019, there was a transformer discovered with a hardware backdoor. These transformers are the backbone of our grid. A hardware backdoor that would allow someone, say, for example, in China, to shut it off remotely. And so this is something that...
And that's where that transformer was manufactured. Is that right?
That's right. I should have mentioned a Chinese transformer. And so what happened is we saw in the port of Houston, another Chinese manufactured transformer seized by federal authorities, brought to Sandia National Laboratories. The Trump administration on May 1st, 2020 declared a grid security emergency and passed an executive order to secure the bulk power system against these sorts of supply chain vulnerabilities. On day one of the Biden administration, that executive order was suspended. And to my best observation, I can't see where it's been replaced with anything of merit. And so at this point, Chinese manufactured components for our grid are here and continue to be inbound for our failure to recognize that as a significant vulnerability.
Yeah. As I understand it, there are some 300 of these Chinese transformers in the grid right now.
And, that's right.
You know, if they all have backdoors or other means of being compromised or simply destroyed remotely, it would be a huge, huge crisis for our electric grid system.
That's right.
I just wanted to switch gears slightly on this because the importance of having both a reliable and a resilient grid should be self-evident. And yet, one of the things that Tucker Carlson has been talking about, including in a very important monologue last night, is the pursuit of this sort of Green New Deal agenda, replacing reliable, as they call it, bulk power systems with renewables, which are dependent upon the wind blowing or the sun shining, is actually, as he put it, impoverishing Europe and putting it in a position which, combined with this, economic warfare going on with Russia at the moment, is likely to make for a devastatingly hard winter in Europe. It's not exactly the same problem as the one we've been talking about, but the practical effect may be not to have heat, not to have, you know, what's necessary for people in cities particularly to survive a harsh winter, which may well be in the offing in Europe. And a reminder to us, if any were needed, that we mustn't let ourselves get into similar straits here. Any thoughts on that subject?
Absolutely, Frank. Look at Germany. Germany shut down all of their nuclear power plants. This is like a political, philosophical, what they thought to be an environmental decision. And so, of course, you remove all of that baseload power production. And mind you, nuclear is clean, carbon-free energy, right? Here in America, we need it. We need every single nuclear plant we can. Now, the Biden administration said they put forth $6 billion in order to keep our nuclear plants afloat. But the part of the reason this is that you even need to subsidize it is because of the incredible subsidies that have been given to wind and solar that make nuclear not as competitive as it should have been. So, Frank, it's a huge issue. We cannot abandon those baseload sources of power that we get from coal, from nuclear, and even from natural gas, because we're not to the point where we have the battery storage capability to harness the energy produced intermittently by wind and solar, as you mentioned. So,
and intermittent is the operative word, of course. Baseload power is a concept that I think all of us had better get our heads around, as well as the need to make sure that our grid is resilient. We commemorate this interview with you, Tommy, to our friend Peter Pry and to his work, and look forward to working with you to carry it on in his absence, alas. We're going to look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. But in the meantime, I hope you found this edition of Securing America to be helpful to you in thinking about how you can help us protect the country we love. We look forward to our next visit. In the meantime, stay well, go forth, and multiply.